Editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Christina Menenti. U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday criticized the Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that was seen as a win for his election rival, former President Donald Trump.
This is a fundamentally new principle, and it's a dangerous precedent because the power of the office will no longer be constrained by the law, even including the Supreme Court of the United States.
Biden said the decision meant Trump was highly unlikely to go on trial before this year's November election for his role in seeking to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The U.S. Supreme Court found on Monday Trump cannot be prosecuted for any actions that were within his constitutional powers as president, but can be for private acts, in a landmark ruling recognizing for the first time any form of presidential immunity from prosecution. Donald Trump's lawyers are asking the Manhattan judge in his hush money criminal case for permission to file a motion to set aside the verdict. AP's Lisa Dwyer has more.
In a letter to Judge Juan Merchan, Trump's lawyer cited the new U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on presidential immunity and asked the judge to delay Trump's sentencing while he weighs the high court's decision and how it could influence the New York case. The Supreme Court has ruled for the first time that former presidents have broad immunity from prosecution. Trump was convicted on 34 counts of falsifying business records arising from what prosecutors say was an attempt to cover up a hush money payment just before the 2016 presidential election. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Beryl has strengthened into a Category 5 hurricane in the eastern Caribbean, the U.S. National Hurricane Center said late Monday. The hurricane was located about 840 miles east-southeast of Jamaica, with maximum sustained winds of up to 160 miles per hour. This is VOA News. Strong winds lashed Grenada on Monday as Hurricane Beryl made landfall in the Caribbean, churning into the Windward Islands and threatening devastating flooding and storm surges. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen reports.
The U.S. National Hurricane Center called the Category 4 storm an extremely dangerous and life-threatening situation. Michael Brennan is the Hurricane Center's director.
You can see the very well-defined eye in both visible and infrared satellite imagery. Beryl has re-strengthened this morning as it's gone through an eyewall replacement cycle. So now is when we're experiencing those catastrophic Category 4 wind conditions in portions of the Grenadines, places like Union Island, Palm Island, Petite Martinique, Petite St. Vincent, Carriacou.
The appearance of a major hurricane this early in the Atlantic hurricane season is rare.
That was Alex Cohen from Reuters. Grenada's prime minister said late Monday that one person has died and authorities had not been able to assess the situation on the other islands. There were initial reports of major damage, but communications are largely down. Grand jury transcripts have been released in the Jeffrey Epstein sexual assault case. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Florida prosecutors knew Jeffrey Epstein sexually assaulted teenage girls before they cut a plea deal with him, long criticized as too lenient. That from transcripts detailing 2006 grand jury testimony. One girl testified she was paid $300 to give Epstein a sexual massage and $200 every time she recruited a friend. The investigation was the first of many by law enforcement into Epstein's rape and sex trafficking of teenagers and how his ties to the rich and powerful seemed to allow him to avoid prison for more than a decade. Under that deal, he was sentenced to 1.5 years in the Palm Beach County jail system, during which he was allowed to go to his office almost daily as part of a work release program. I'm Ben Thomas.
South Korean Joint Chiefs of Staff spokesperson Lee Sung-jun says its military has responded to North Korea's Tuesday report that it had test-fired a new tactical ballistic missile capable of carrying a huge warhead, saying it is highly possible that it was deception. North Korea is pushing to modernize its weapons arsenal to cope with what it calls U.S.-led threats. Iran's two presidential candidates are accusing each other of having no solution for the country's problems ahead of Friday's runoff election. This election is aimed at choosing a successor for the late President Ebrahim Raisi, who died last month in a helicopter crash. You'll find expanded coverage of world news and events at our website, voanews.com, 24 hours a day. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, follow Voice of America on X, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Provisional results show that Mauritanian President Ghazouani has won re-election.
The Electoral Commission still has to confirm the provisional results before they are sent to the Constitutional Council for final validation.
We'll have analysis of the new cabinet in South Africa's Government of National Unity. A senior Guinean military officer dies under suspicious circumstances. Uganda's parliament meets today, Tuesday, to reconsider an appropriation bill returned to the legislation by President Museveni.
There has been a running battle between parliament in Uganda and President Museveni over who has the final say on the budget.
And the U.S. Supreme Court grants partial immunity to Donald Trump. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. With 99% of the vote counted by Sunday afternoon, Mauritania's National Elections Commission forecast that President Mohamed Ould Cheikh El Ghazouani will get more than 56% of vote cast. That puts him well ahead of rival and human rights activist Biram Dah Abe, who is predicted to win 22% of the vote. Noura Hafiyat has the details from Tunisia.
Mauritanian President Mohamed Ould Cheikh El Ghazouani seems well on his way to securing a second five-year term after the continuing of 99% of all polling stations suggests he has garnered more than 56% of the vote. The Electoral Commission still has to confirm the provisional results before they are sent to the Constitutional Council for final validation. However, the main opposition leader, human rights activist Biram Dah Abe, says he will not recognize the results because he says Ghazouani controls the Election Commission. He said his supporters will take to the streets in a peaceful protest to reject the Electoral Commission count. Yasmin Abdallah supports Abid. She notes there are concerns the military will become involved in backing Ghazouani, a former general.
Some candidates have begun to question these results, a phenomenon that is common and recurring in Mauritania and similar countries. In an African country from the third world, the influence of the military wind is expected.
Last Sunday afternoon, Abid headquarters were surrounded by security forces. Tahia Lahbib is president of the Mauritanian Women's Union, which generally supports the president. She prized the election process as fair and just. She says it was a transparent process, although she had reservation about some of the mistakes that occurred. She says the country has been ruled by the military for a long period of time, and that will not quickly change. Ghazouani came to office after winning election in 2019, the first transition from one elected president to another, and since the country won independence from France, news reporters said there were some clashes when security forces blocked Abid and his supporters from marching to the Election Commission headquarters. Aisha bin Abdul Aziz, a pro-democracy activist, downplayed the confrontation.
المرشح برام الداه عبيد برفضه للنتائج مما فهمه بعض مناصريه بأنها دعوة غير مباشرة.
Abdul Aziz says Biram Abid rejected the results, which some of his supporters understood as an indirect call for protests. But the situation is not seen as alarming yet. Noura Fayed, Voice of America, Tunisia.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa's announcement of a cabinet for the new government of national unity has ended a month-long speculation of posts for the diverse partners in the inclusive and racially diverse administration. This, after intense negotiations and fears that the coalition could collapse before it begins. Professor Christopher Isike is head of the Department of Political Science at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He tells viewers Chinedu Ofor that while some say the 32-member cabinet appears to be bloated, it was necessary considering the makeup of the parties involved.
For an administration that promised that government was going to be smaller and leaner, this has been an increase. But if you look at the fact that it's a government of national unity comprising of 11 parties which all agree to have some kind of representation in government, then it's not as big as people would really think if you look at it from that perspective. But it's a bloated government. However, there are some strategic ministries that have been granted to the Democratic Alliance, which used to be the opposition party now in governance with the ANC.
Is it significant that the leader of the main opposition party was giving the agriculture ministry?
It is significant because, of course, agriculture is something that is the bane of the economic activity of a lot of white people. There are a lot of white farmers. The farming industry is largely controlled by white people in South Africa. So it is something they're interested in, especially with issues around policies and farm killings that take place. So it's not surprising that they decided to go that way, and there's no hindrance from government policies to food production in the country. So that's an important ministry to have.
Is this a message to hardliner Julius Malema, who is talking about taking over white-owned lands and distributing it? Is this a message to him from President Ramaphosa that there's no land reform in the immediate future?
It could be that, but the ANC will still be in charge of the land reform portfolio with the deputy minister DAs. I think that it helps to counterbalance whatever opposition people may get. But I think all these parties that are in alignment, the level of them, coalition, government of national unity, their goal is to ensure that the constitution is represented, that the economy continues to grow through new initiatives and effective policy, evidence-based policy making that will now be the priority of the new government. So to that extent, things will not change much in terms of land reform, especially as it has to do with the constitution, changing the constitution. I think that's the main reason why the DA actually went into this coalition, because prefer to be in bed with the ANC than allow the ANC to have a coalition with the EFF and the MK party that have clearly stated their opposition to land reforms as it currently is practiced and changing the constitution.
With myriads of problems of South Africa, do you think this cabinet has the personnel, has the experience, has the expertise to deliver?
Yes, I would say yes. The cabinet is a mix of experienced hands, new faces, position, and then a lot of young people. Some of them have also been in government, served as deputy ministers. There's been promotion of some young people, like the new minister for international relations, was former minister of justice, had experience with the South African case at the ICJ, had a taste of international politics and international relations broadly. So you have a mix of youth, gender, experience, all put together, and they have an operative principle. They are committed to setting priorities that will make well for policy and decision making and ensure that the economy is open, ensure that there's integrity and transparency in government. If they keep to those principles, if they stick to them and not focus on their party needs and their individual needs, then it may just work out.
Professor Christopher Isike is the head of the Department of Political Sciences at the University of Pretoria. He was speaking from Boston, Massachusetts, with viewers Chinedu Ofor. Uganda's parliament is scheduled to meet in a special session today, Tuesday, to reconsider an appropriations bill returned to the legislature after President Yoweri Museveni refused to sign it into law. Local media reports that the president declined after accusing lawmakers of tampering with the measure without authority from the executive. Ibrahim Semuju is a member of the Ugandan parliament. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that many of his fellow lawmakers do not read documents before approving them.
There has been a running battle between parliament in Uganda and President Museveni over who has the final say on the budget. The president is always angry that parliament reallocates money in the budget. So by July 1st is when the new financial year begins, And the Uganda Public Finance and Management Act states that the annual budget starts on day one of July. So even as I speak to you, we are in a crisis. We don't know which financial regime the government is going to be operating. Because if you read our constitution, the constitution says if the appropriation bill for one reason or another is not in force, the president may direct finance to release money to run the government for a period of 4 months. But the letter he has returned to parliament is a letter that does not state the specific reason he's returning or he has declined to assent to the bill.
The question a lot of people are asking is, parliament passed this appropriations bill. Did they not read it before passing it? Was there no coordination between the executive and the legislative arm branch of government?
First of all, majority of MPs in Uganda don't read the budget documents. There are too many documents. The revenue and estimates alone is about 8,000 pages. And then there are sector by sector policy statements, each about 600 pages. So these documents require a lot of dedication to read and understand them. Many of the MPs don't even know the law under which the budget is done. That's why Museveni is taking advantage. But even his own ministers, because Museveni has 8+ ministers who sit in parliament, none of them raised any objection on May 16th when we are processing the budget. So which means either you have a cabinet that has resigned to its fate or they fear to stand up to their supervisor, or like many MPs, they are also not reading the budget documents.
So as the shadow minister, what are your expectations for how Tuesday's budget reconsideration or appropriations bill will go?
We will, as opposition, raise objections, legal and other objections. First of all, during the time of processing the budgeting, not the finance minister, there are 5 of them, not his deputies, nor any other minister ever raised any objection. And these are the representative of the president in parliament. In fact, the law on Public Finance and Management Act says the Minister of Finance on behalf of the president will present the annual budget. He did present it. So they did not raise any objection. We are now 1 day into the new financial year. We don't know whether the appropriation bill will work and how it has been returned. We don't know whether Mr. Museveni, using Article 91 of the Constitution, has ordered the Treasury to release the money. So we'll be asking them, why did they sleep on the job? And if there is no objection, is this country run by one man? So if he coughs, the ministers must come running to parliament.
Ibrahim Semuju is a member of the Uganda Parliament. He spoke from Kampala with viewers Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington today. It's Tuesday, July 2nd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A total of 39 people have been killed in anti-government demonstrations in Kenya, the National Rights Watchdog said on Monday, as activists geared up for a new round of protests this week. The French news agency AFP says the toll announced by the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights is almost double the figure previously disclosed by the authorities for those killed while contesting a raft of deep play on popular tax increases that have now been withdrawn. The commission also said there had been 32 cases of enforced or involuntary disappearances and 627 arrests of protesters. Young Kenyans, mostly members of the Generation Z, have been a leading force against the parliamentary bill that raises taxes, giving protests a new face. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
Raham Wenyi and Clarence Kiragu join other protesters for a demonstration in the streets of Nairobi.
I am unstoppable!
We cannot be intimidated, they sing. These young adults say they have taken to the streets to call for the withdrawal of a bill to raise taxes, which they say is punitive.
They're taxing everything that's essential to us. You even have people from everywhere, middle class, upper class, we are all here to protest against this bill. So that should show you the gravity of this situation. Shouldn't the aim of the government be to improve the standards of living?
Unlike previous political protests in Kenya, these protests are largely led by members of Generation Z, people born in the late 1990s and early 2000s. They are largely using social media to mobilize. Kiragu says their tactics have been successful.
We're using social media as a platform to show them that we cannot be contained. They want us here until 6, we'll protest until 8, we'll protest until midnight. In all platforms, we'll be here to tell them that that finance bill needs to go. Reject the finance bill.
Socio-political protests in Kenya have, in the past, largely been led by politicians and their supporters without the involvement of young people. Chief Nyamwea, another protester, says his generation's motivations are different.
We have been governed by fear since independence. All other preceding generations, every move they make is determined by fear. This is the generation that will end that fear so that we can give life to the Constitution. The Constitution is not just a toilet paper.
Kenyan police fired when demonstrators stormed the legislature. Kiragu says the brutality of the police will not deter them.
Yeah, Gen Z are the ones leading and they know that, but they are still deploying their police officers, tear gassing people like it's a normal day activity. That's definitely wrong.
Kenyan President William Ruto said the tax debate had been, quote, hijacked by dangerous people. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
Sources told the French news agency AFP on Monday that a humanitarian convoy was attacked in the war-ravaged eastern DRC, an area blighted by clashes between M23 rebels and government forces. The UK organization TFound said in a statement that two members of staff are still missing following the attack that took place in North Kivu province. The former number two man of Guinea's military junta, General Sadiba Koulibaly, has died in Conakry under suspicious circumstances, according to his lawyer. Reporter Karim Kamara has the story from Conakry.
Residents of Conakry have been forced to limit their movement around the city at midnight, and vehicles entering the city center after working hours are subjected to vigorous searches by security forces. The situation follows the announcement by the military junta of the death of General Sadiba Koulibaly, the former number two man and former chief of staff of the military junta. Since then, panic has gripped Guineans. Authorities say an autopsy was conducted on the body of Koulibaly at the Inyasin Hospital, one of the government-owned facilities here in Conakry. At military headquarters located at Camp Samori Touré military barracks, soldiers paid their last respect to the late general. According to a statement released by the Office of the Prosecutor at the military court, the autopsy reveals that he died of heart attack caused by prolonged depression and stress. His lawyer says his client did not die of natural causes because he did not complain of any heart condition throughout his trial.
On a été informé tard la nuit que General Sadiba Koulibaly est mort.
He says they were informed late in the night that their client, General Sadiba Koulibaly, had died of natural causes. He says from the preliminary investigations until the day of the trial, they have been demanding that their client be sent to the main central prison after he had been sentenced. But he says nobody paid attention to them. He says until the day of trial, their client never told them that he was sick. He also says lawyers of the late general have not received a report of the autopsy. The junta arrested General Koulibaly in late June, shortly after he returned to Guinea from Cuba, where he was serving as Guinea's ambassador. They charged him with deserting his post and of planning to overthrow the military junta. They then demoted him from the rank of general to colonel before he was finally sacked from the Guinean army. Sadiba vehemently denied the charges and said he was in Conakry with the consent of the foreign minister to arrange payment for his staff in Cuba, who had been without salaries for several months. But the court rejected his defense and sentenced him to 5 years imprisonment. Sadiba died few days after his sentence. There is widespread speculation that the late general did not die of natural death, and right groups and the Guinean Bar Association are calling for an independent inquiry into the issue. Abubakar Konte is a member of the Association of Equal Rights and Justice for All.
From the statement issued by the prosecutor at military court, General Saliba Koulibaly died on the 22nd June. Why did they wait until the 25th to announce his death? Also, a sudden death took place just within a few days after he was sentenced by the military court. So, this brings about doubt over how he died. His lawyer said before the death of client, he was in good health and he was taken to court. So therefore, this is why we are calling for an independent investigation into what I should call the suspected death of the general.
Sadiba Koulibaly fell from grace in 2003 after junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya sacked him as chief of staff. He was later sent as Guinea's ambassador to Cuba, a post many considered as a punishment. The government and military junta have been tight-lipped as to their side of the story. Meanwhile, several top military officers close to the late general have been arrested, accused of planning to overthrow the military junta. The military is on high alert in Conakry as a result. Koulibaly's body was taken to his hometown of Magalifaraba in the district of Manjana in Upper Guinea, over 500 kilometers from the capital, Conakry, where he was laid to rest on Friday. Thousands of people in his hometown lined up to welcome the arrival of the body. Not a single member of either the junta or the government attended the burial. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
In an important and historical decision, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that four U.S. presidents have limited immunity from prosecution. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman has details from Washington.
In a 6-3 decision split along ideological lines, the justices on the United States Supreme Court sent back to a lower court the criminal case against former President Donald Trump, in which he is charged with plotting to overthrow the presidential election 4 years ago. The majority of the court declared former presidents have absolute immunity from prosecution for their official acts. However, they do not have immunity from what are deemed unofficial acts. The outcome will further delay a special counsel's case against Trump, who is alleged to have tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election after he lost to Joe Biden. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Tuesday, July 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Butler in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
Historically, politics have been viewed as a male-dominated area. It has been said that women participation in politics is a good judgment of a country's attitude towards gender inclusivity. This week in Our Voices, we'll take a closer look at young African women leading politically. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source for news.
Hello, this is Linor Moudou, host of Health Chat.
Join me for the latest in health news, wellness tips, medical breakthroughs, and much more. Our experts inside the United States and beyond will share some insights on living a healthy life. Tuesdays at